Good morning, this is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the August 19th, 2021 meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners. CJ Rosella, Director of Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Good morning, this is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for specific Rhode Island Housing staff, participants telephonically in the meeting, all callers are asked to mute their phones during the meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, we ask telephone participants to please mute your telephones if you are not speaking. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. This is Carol Ventura. Corinne Myers, Acting General Counsel for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this public meeting.
Good morning, this is Corinne Myers, Acting General Counsel. This meeting is being held in hybrid fashion with all members of the Board of Commissioners appearing in person and specific RA Housing staff participating via teleconference. This is in keeping with the Rhode Island Open Meetings Act. Members of the public can access the meeting in person or via teleconference according to their preference. In addition, members of the public can visit the RA Housing website to view today's agenda and information on the actions being taken. If the teleconference is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until we can reconnect the audio. Chairman Racinus will preside at today's meeting. Commissioners and staff, when you speak during the meeting, whether you are in person or communicating via telephone, please do state your name prior to speaking. This is for the benefit of members of the public who may be listening in or accessing the recording at a later date. If applicable, please mute your telephone or computer to minimize any background noise. Now I will turn it over to Chairman Racinus to call the meeting to order.
Thank you, Corey. Chair, I welcome you to the, I call the meeting to order of Rhode Island Housing. Let's start with roll call attendance.
Chairman Nicholas Racinus.
Here.
Commissioner James Dorfman.
Here.
Commissioner Liz Tanner.
Here.
Commissioner Designee Leanne Burns.
Present.
Commissioner Kevin Orr.
Here.
Commissioner Steve McAllister.
Here.
Staff of Rhode Island Housing. Lisa Primiano.
Here.
Carol LaChapelle.
Here.
Leslie McKnight.
Here.
Christine Hunsinger.
Here.
Clark L. Shaver.
Here.
Ann Berman.
Here.
Amy Reynolds.
Here.
Corinne Myers.
Here.
CJ Rotella.
Here.
Outside counsel Stephen Richards.
Present via telephone.
Thank you. You have before you the minutes of our last regular board meeting on June 17th. Is there a motion to approve those minutes?
Motion to approve.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, let's take a vote.
This is Corinne Myers. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you're in favor of approving the minutes of the board meeting held on June 17th, 2021, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Racinus.
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns.
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister.
Aye.
Commissioner Orth.
Aye.
Director Tanner.
Aye.
Director Thorson.
Aye.
The motion is approved by a unanimous vote.
Great. You have the minutes of our last special board meeting, June 29th, before you. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none, let's take a vote.
This is Corinne Myers speaking. Commissioners, again, when I call your name, if you're in favor of approving the minutes of the special board meeting held on June 29th, 2021, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Racinus.
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns.
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister.
Aye.
Commissioner Orth.
Aye.
Director Tanner.
Aye.
Director Thorson.
I believe I have to abstain since I wasn't here.
Thank you. The ayes have it. The motion carries.
Thank you. Let's turn our attention to our executive director for her monthly report.
Thank you, Chairman. Rather than going through the EDU's report that you have in front of you, I've invited some of our staff to come in and make a presentation on Rapid Response Act. There's been a lot of discussion about this program, a lot of press around this program, so I thought it was timely to present this certificate to you. because I want to give an overview of how it fits here in Rhode Island Housing. Because the program involves rental and utility subsidies, we house the program in our youth housing area under Clarabelle Shaver, the director of the division. We onboarded a program manager, Deb Devine, who was recently the executive assistant to the former executive director. And she oversees the day-to-day operations with program staff who, you know, their sole task is really to evaluate what comes in and approve applications. As you might imagine, Amy Raynone plays a major role in working with all of the state officials, municipal officials, and local folks around promoting the program, marketing the program, and providing periodic updates. Christine Hunsinger has coordinated the design of the program, engaging with community partners, and managing the vendors and the technology that we have that supports the program. Along with Corey Myers, Christine negotiated the contract with the state for this program and continues to work actively with state departments to coordinate with them. Most recently, Christine and the team was successful in working with National Grid to pull a list of people who have arrearages on their utilities and then coordinate with DHS and DLT to try to get the list narrowed down to people that would be immediately eligible for assistance under the program. Both Christine and Amy participate in national calls with our trade association and treasury officials to try to make the program, to try to improve the program so that it's easier for Rhode Islanders to access the program. So I am going to give you an update on where we stand as of today. They had a huge day yesterday with 20 people working together to approve applications. And as of today, we've extended more than $14 million to over 1,900 households, almost 2,000 households. So we're very pleased with that. And now let me turn it over to Clarabelle.
Thank you. Clarabelle Shaver, Director of Leaf Housing. So when we rolled out our rent relief program, we were unsure what it would entail. We had experience with Housing Help RI, but after reading the Treasury's guidance, we realized that there were going to be more requirements than there were under the Housing Help RI program. So we initially rolled out with a smaller group than we have right now. Right now, we've expanded our staffing. We have 18 Rhode Island Housing staff working on the program, with 15 of us having approving authority. And this includes staffing that are long-term staff, temporary staff, and people from other departments that have, you know, come together to help to get the program up and running. We also have our partner call center. They have 130 call center staff helping. They process applications and they deal with the day-to-day calls that come in. We also soon realized that we needed to improve our training or kind of retrain our staff and our partners. We wanted to focus on consistency, and we wanted to preserve the program integrity while also increasing the speed in which we review and approve applications. So initially, our case management was about assigning cases based on date, time, and priority of the application. The second level of reviews were not as consistent as we like it to be. Soon we changed that approach. So the approach became more about showing, obviously, training and the approvers to show consistency. And then we try to assign cases by landlords. So we have, you know, a landlord who's got multiple tenants, you know, tenants, or then if we assign it to one case auditor, that landlord's not getting 10 different emails from 10 different auditors asking for the same information. We also went back to the Treasury guidance and tried to see if we could identify opportunities to further streamline the process, and we were able to do that. We reduced a lot of the landlord and tenant documentation requirements. We allow for self-attestation if no documentation is available for income or COVID impact, but of course we make an attempt to collect that information. If we think that the applicant does not have it, then we'll accept the self-attestation. We also did further streamlining of the process for our affordable developments and our public housing authorities. We know that these housing authorities and our management agents do their due diligence when they admit families to the program and when they recertify the families. So we removed the IC requirements for families that live in these developments or in public housing. We also know that public housing authorities and our management agents of these properties already have income information for these applicants. So we're going to rely on their most recent income served. That way we're not going back to the applicants, asking them for pay stubs or any kind of an income documentation. We're now able, or management agents or public housing authorities are able to add a tenant who's past due in rent directly to the system. And that way we don't have to wait for the families to register, go online and do anything. We collect the information directly from the management agents or public housing authorities. And also we assign cases by property to one auditor and supervisor. Again, so we can show consistency, and that way the customer service can improve as well. We also increased staffing, as mentioned earlier, with our call center and internally with our housing staff as it relates to approval authority. And just like Carol mentioned, we're now collaborating with National Grid for a further streamlined process to see if we could do bulk payments for eligible families in the state of Rhode Island. I think in the PowerPoint presentation, you'll see on slide 5, there's some statistics to show how, as we improve, as we make these changes, how we've improved the outcomes. You'll see that the daily and the weekly average spending has increased from every month, from June to July and August, and in some cases it's doubled. In that slide, you'll also see that the number of cases that are being approved have also improved and in some cases doubled. And we continue to improve. We continue to make changes and we continue to streamline and train teams so we can get more money out the door to the eligible families. That is all I have. I will be open to any questions.
We're talking about constantly improving, and recently one area that Chris and his team looked at was, you know, what is the COVID impact? We're asking people to write out what their COVID impact is. And Christine and the team developed sentences. This is my COVID impact. And they can check a box to make it much easier, because what we were getting back were these long, rambling narratives about what was impacting them when it could easily be a sentence. That's a health sentence. So have we implemented that yet, Chris?
Yes.
So turn it over to Amy.
Thank you, Carol. Amy Raynone. So as Carol mentioned, we have been doing a lot of outreach and engagement across a broad spectrum of partners in the community. With our sort of community-based organizations, we did an e-blast out to 2,900 of our community partners, and then have been following up. Some of those partners just took that and ran with it. We've got a whole toolkit on the website of tools that folks can use to get the word out, newsletter content, social media blasts, one-pagers, all kind of stuff that partners can just sort of take and run with. And many of them have done that, and I hope you've been seeing some of that activity on social media. But in addition to that, we did follow-ups with some particular partners that we thought would be particularly impactful, especially for the communities we're trying to reach out to. So we sent out 2,500 flyers to the food banks. They've been distributing those through the food bank networks across the state. We've reached out to the faith-based community. The Interfaith Coalition has been pushing this information through their member churches, in addition to some of the larger faith-based organizations are also working to get that information out through their parishes. Libraries, the same way, we've been reaching out to the entire library network to make sure that the information is available through the different libraries across the state. Now with the schools going back in, getting ready to go back in, we're focusing a lot on that school network. And we had this week 7,000 backpacks were stuffed in the Providence school system for with rent relief packages going out to those students. Newport backpacks were stuffed last week with rent relief flyers, so they received that information. And we're continuing to work with that system. Can we get it in open houses? Can we get it through robocalls or whatever to the school populations? And we're also reaching out to folks like the Boys and Girls Club and other community-based organizations. In addition to that, we reached out to the entire General Assembly and similarly have had specific follow-up with certain of those members who have expressed an interest or where there's a need to really dig into the populations that they serve. We've done streaming presentations that they make available to their folks, as well as providing them with materials that they can canvas the neighborhoods with. Same with the municipalities. Everybody got reached out to, all of the elected officials, as well as the Human Service Department personnel at the municipal level. We've been putting materials available in the city halls. They've been pushing it out through their outreach to community members. And we have more of those again that are still pending. That's on top of the sort of traditional media campaign. So we have over $250,000 media campaign underway. Hopefully folks have seen some of the TV ads. We're on the radio, English and Spanish radio. We're in English and Spanish print ads in the newspapers, as well as I think Chris has given every interview that is possible to give to every media outlet in the state, as has Carabel in Spanish. So we've had English and Spanish on TV, in radio, and in these live presentations. So a lot happening. The word is getting out on the program. And with that, I want to turn it over to Chris.
Thank you. This is Chris Hunsinger. Just to touch on a few of the efforts to hit a bigger audience. So we've talked about National Grid. We're waiting for that data to come back from the state, which will be matched with DHS and DLT data. We'll separate it out into renters and homeowners, put a hold on the homeowners for a little bit, and then work on with that renter population. The folks who have a DHS program, whether it's LIHEAP or the National Grid Low Income Rate is something that they receive. We know they're income qualified. We know that they're on the housing instability question, that they have a past due balance. So it's just that hardship piece, which is really where the idea to try to streamline that form came from and to give them options. And only if they couldn't fit themselves into those buckets, to have them write out what it was. So we're waiting on that to come back, and we will chase all of them. It'll be broken down into a couple of buckets. Some grid only has mailing addresses for, so we'll mail to them incessantly until we get told to stop. Some they have emails for, so we'll mail and email. Some they have email, phone, and so we'll do outbound calls and things like that. So our goal is to try to capture as many of those folks, get them to come in, pay their utility bill as fast as we can, because we already know the amount, right? Grid has confirmed for us the amount. And then to have them come in and give us landlord information and if they owe arrearages and rental information. So we think that there's about somewhere between $10 and $15 million in that group that we can get. It says 20 here because there are folks that are going to fall outside of what we can qualify in this program, and folks that won't respond. But we think somewhere between $10 and $15 million that we can do with this very streamlined form. So it's one and a little pages. So we're happy that we're able to cut down on the paperwork there. We're working with DHS. They're going to mail to all, it's over 300,000 families, households, for all of the folks who are on their program, let them know how to come in. So we hope that once those go out, they're going to stagger them so as not to kill us. But we hope that once those mailings go out, we'll start to see an uptick in interest and applications coming in. Probably the most successful piece of our partner outreach that we have is our courthouse program. So we've got folks in the courthouses. They man a table. If you are coming in for your eviction hearing today and you haven't applied, you can apply right there. And the folks who work those tables are amazing and incredible. So if you're the tenant or the landlord, they talk to both of you. We've had staff in those buildings convince landlords who had refused to participate before to come in and participate. Once you do that application process or begin it, you're able to go into court and say, yeah, okay, we're gonna give this program a try. If you haven't completed your application, staff at those tables know what you're missing, and they work with you right there to see if you can access it via your phone or a laptop or have somebody bring it down and get those documents in. Very often, judges will come out and ask the folks who are sitting at the table, what's the status of this case? You know, how long until it gets paid? Or are they going to be approved and things like that? So it's really a very effective frontline effort and kind of connects with folks at that last possible moment before they go in and get an order entered against them. So we're very proud of that. We've engaged Advocacy Solutions to help us do increased media buying, which Amy talked to you about, and hopefully you've seen we've got TV commercials and all of that. And they are also working with us on this outreach and engagement for municipalities, legislatures, and partner organizations. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about the $200 million number, which is an amazing amount of money. We've been tracking all of the, well, maybe not all of them, there's a lot of them. We've been tracking the analysis of the need that's been being done by organizations. And one of the groups that we've been following, because they've been pretty close to right throughout the pandemic, and then they come back and they update their information with what's transpired, was the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank. And they released a report on July 30th that kind of pegged the need for pandemic-related past due rent at about $25 million and about 3,200 renters. Now, it's an emergency program in response to the pandemic. That's not to say that that's all the need for rental assistance that's out there, but that's a pretty good guess about what's pandemic-related and what can easily fit into this bucket. I mean, it's mimicking what we're seeing as far as applications come in. So over 50% of the applicants that come into the program are 30% of AMI or below. So these are folks who struggle, even without the pandemic conditions, to make that housing payment, right? So we're seeing that. And it's only 15% of the total applications that are at the 50 to 80%. So it's really that those folks that like struggle for housing payments normally, so the day before COVID and the day after. So that's what we're seeing. Amy walked around and gave you, I think, a copy of the dashboard. It's on our website. It gets updated every day at 11:30, so these are yesterday's numbers. But I just wanted to make sure that you could see what we're reporting out. So every weekday, it gets updated. And so you'll see how many folks have come in and created an account. Those are not completed or submitted applications. Those are applicants that still need to do something. But we've got 3,600 submitted applications that we're making our way through. You can see that as of yesterday, we had 1,850, just over that, approved, 61 denied or in appeal. So I want to talk about the denied bucket for a minute. Those are folks who don't qualify. They're over income, in some instances there was something pretty funky with their application that didn't sit right with staff. So those are people who definitely don't qualify that we tell no. That's why the appeal number is in there. If they come in and question how we calculated their income and things like that, we have 10 days to make our way through that and just make a determination. This active and inactive and withdrawn bucket is really important. Those are folks who we have not been able to contact. On the tenant side, we reach out to you 3 times within 14 days. That's the program guidance. In reality, we've spent a lot of time trying to get in touch with these people. So we just recently, within the past 3 or 4 weeks, started to deny people for being inactive. So we chased them for a long time, and now we're starting to do that so we can focus our resources on folks who are actively seeking assistance. You can see up above that the non-responsive and then the withdrawn number. This 368, this withdrawn number, are people who've told us they no longer need the assistance. We only find that out through our outreach efforts. Almost no one calls us and said, hey, I created an application, I don't need it anymore. So you're going to see this number go up and the non-responsive number go up as we do. We started to report out how many applicants were paying directly. We feel like that's a relevant number. And then you can see the demographics on the next page. By income, by gender, by race, by ethnicity. It'll show you the dollar value, so under denied, that $3.6 million. That's the value of those applications. That's what they asked for when they came in that have been denied. Denied will include withdrawn, folks who said they didn't need it anymore, and the non-responsive. So you'll be able to see how many dollars didn't make it through. Average assistance is about $7,000. That's going to include your forward-facing rent. And you can see how that assistance is broken down by category there. Past due and forward-facing and utilities and other stuff. On the next page, this is the applicant pool total. right? Here's on the one that we were looking before, those are the approved applications. We thought it was important to show both to make sure that we're keeping pace on the demographics so that, you know, if 56% of the population with 30% of AMI, that we are approving those at the right pace and right amount. Also race, gender, and those kinds of things. And then we've got on the last page of the dashboard, by municipality. So approvals by municipality and applications by municipality.
The only other thing I would add is we started paying out on broadband. So we provide a $50 monthly stipend for broadband. And I don't think it's on here, but it's probably longer than the studies, but we have got to add on that to see what that is.
You'll see that number in the approved other expenses, I think. But I can double check. It's either in other expenses or utilities.
Thank you. Thank
you, Shannon, for letting us provide this report.
Thank you.
Any
questions on his presentation on
IEDs? Chris, can I ask if there's a way to calculate the average turnaround time?
There isn't at this moment, and here's why. Everybody is aware that we had a technology issue and we had to import, so it delayed things. We also kept them open for a lot longer than we would have if things had run smoothly. Our goal is 21 days from start of an application payout. We're going to empty out the non-responses. We're doing them 100 at a time, so in case those people appeal, we don't get overwhelmed with the appeal. But we've got about 1,500 of them that have been non-responsive so far. So we're about a month away from being able to tell you. It also depends on whether or not the application's complete. But we're getting to a place where we'll be able to give you that time as a baseline, and then you can watch it improve, hopefully.
And is there a way to do a deeper dive in the need additional information section to understand, you know, what it is that is needed? Is it always the same thing? Is it diverse? What is it?
So we work with the call center. Each case has been gone through. We have a list of documents that are required or information that's required. So in the system, you can see. And so every time someone calls you to say, hey, I need something, they can see exactly what you're missing. Yep, I know you gave me your income information last time. I need you to sign the self-assist station. So we didn't think it made sense to report out all the categories because then every bucket would only be this big. But we do have real-time line of sight into what each one needs, and they're working on it. It goes in every email, what they still need, and every phone call when a message is able to be left.
So you just said self-attestation. Can they do it digitally, or they have to print it out?
They can do it digitally.
Great.
Or they can print it out and take a picture. They can do it any number of ways. We'll take it in any form we can get it.
Great, thank you.
Chris,
for the outreach, I've been part of that. We set up in Warwick. The team came out. We met with Mayor Picozzi to get the information out to his directors and staff, try to talk about it at each council meeting, because just making people aware, that's a thing right now.
Yep.
We need to target as many people as possible, and as you always say, meet them where they're at. One suggestion I have is working with the CCATs, they give out LIHEAP money. I think that's a target list right there that, if you qualify for federal LIHEAP money, I'm assuming you're going to qualify for this. That could be another outreach that you can do. I don't know if they can give that information out or what, but it may be another group, a large group that I think would be a target-rich group.
Yeah, so on the CAPS, several of them are partners. When we put out the RFP, several of them bid, several of them are partners, several of them are not. On the LIHEAP specifically, they're receiving communications from us in about three different ways. So through the DHS mailing, through the National Grid mailing, and then our outreach directly to that list. We've worked with DHS and the CAPS to get a list of all of their oil and propane providers. So we've RFP'd recently so that we have the ability to pay those utilities as the weather warrants and those bills start to come in. So we are working with them, but we're meeting with several CAP agencies next week and the week after to see if we can't do more and collaborate more. So I appreciate the suggestion.
Yeah, excellent. It's just, because it's not just spreading out. You can target it as much as possible too, and those are good. I'm happy to work with you with West Bay if I know you guys have great relationships with them, but
yeah.
I'm happy to coordinate for
we
you
have
as well.
A meeting coming up with them.
Oh, great.
Other questions?
I have a few questions.
Yes.
Christine, keying off that comment on outreach, I noticed in the dashboard that there's an eviction notice received There's 8,700 or 8,800 notices, most not received. Have those folks been, is the outreach to those folks as well? Because it would seem that what I'm asking is, are we tracking eviction notices and what's going on in the courthouse? And how many have been filed and how the moratorium has affected eviction and what the trend line looks like? Because I know there's a moratorium, so there must be pent-up demand.
So we're doing all of that. This yes number is a little misleading because lots of folks get a 5-day demand from their landlord and think it's an eviction notice because it says, if you don't, then we will. But it's a decent proxy. What we do with the courts, and we have worked with them since we knew we were going to have this program. We met with them weekly as we were standing it up. We meet with them every 2 weeks now. They send us a calendar of folks who have eviction hearings for as far as it's scheduled in the future. We keep that list. We match them to folks who are in our system. People who aren't in our system, we mail to because the court only has mailing address information, so we mail to them. The folks that are in our system, the eviction notice factors into the prioritization. So the federal government mandates that we have a prioritization system, and eviction notice was the one that we added on top of income and days unemployed. So Housing Network is one of our partners on the ground that helps to process applications. They are solely devoted to the eviction cases. So if the folks in the courthouse call and say, you know, we need to know now, this answer has to happen, they are able to respond in real time. Also, our partners, Center for Justice and Rhode Island Legal Services, represent many of the folks who have an eviction hearing. They're also a partner and are able to help assist completing the applications. So as they're going into court or as they're struggling with a tenant who's got an eviction notice, they're able to call a Housing Network and get kind of priority attention on those because they're a higher priority categorization anyway. That's how we've been dealing with it. We are tracking data on evictions overall. So obviously the courts were closed and there's a moratorium, so they've gone down. What we estimate is that there's about 5,000, 5,500 evictions that would have happened anyway had there been no COVID, right? The annual average. So there's that number of folks who probably would have come in anyway. We believe them to be in this bucket of applicants. They are folks who struggle on a normal day, and we believe that they are in this bucket of applicants. So we're doing everything we can to kind of complete those cases before there's an order issued. We've worked to identify where there's already been an order issued and contacted those folks, and in some instances been able to get them back on track, get the landlord to participate in all of that so that those folks won't be subject to eviction or being moved out once the moratorium does lift. And a lot of those folks have resolved their situation on their own. So when we mailed to everybody who had a judgment issued against them for possession, there were about 2,000 of them. There were about 200 in our system that we were working through. Of the 1,800 that were left, about 900 letters came back as the person doesn't live there anymore. So they've moved, they've made different arrangements, I think the phrase that we use is self-resolved. So, you know, we still mail to that those 900 that didn't return the mail, but we continue to get letters back.
So the number in process, it wasn't quite clear when you did the, when you explained the number in process. I understand we got backlogged a little bit because we had the hiccup with the systems and it took a while to get the program up and running, but on page 2 of the dashboard, you have an in-process number that shows 32 million. And we talked about how your goal is 21 days to process. I just want to know if the in-process number is going up or down.
So the in-process number on this dashboard, and I think I've had this question before, we need to clarify what this is. It's really, I don't do math out loud, so if I'm wrong, you can let me know. I think it's the total amount requested minus approved and denied. So it's a little vague, right? So that would be everything that was asked for, but lots of times people are eligible for more or eligible for less. So that's just kind of what we thought people would be interested in like a potential pipeline. If everything could be approved tomorrow, it would be worth that. Obviously, not everything can be approved tomorrow, but that's kind of the potential that exists within this program right now.
Chris, I think what I was asking is related to, we know that there was a bit of a hiccup with, with the system, and that backlogged some of the process. And what I'm trying to get a sense for is, have we worked that down, that backlog, so
yeah.
we have more efficient processing now, we're achieving that 21 days to process goal?
Yep. So, there, like I said, there's about 1,500 that are inactive and are being denied 100 at a time. Their value is approximately $10 million. So that's what I think most of the backlog is. That's why we're denying them 100 at a time, so that if we miss somebody and they really meant to be responsive and weren't, they can appeal and we can handle it right away. But that's really where the backlog is. So you'll see those numbers on the non-responsive come down. They're right now on the first page of the dashboard. They're in need additional information.
Okay. All right, just as a sort of a disturbing data point, and I don't expect you to comment on this, but I have a friend who does tenant-landlord dispute work, and he's telling me that irrespective of the moratorium, he was proceeding with some evictions on the basis of the lease running out, and that was a way of getting around the moratorium, because some landlords have determined that it's a safer bet for them and less of a business risk just to get the tenant out released than it is to go through this program. I found that kind of disturbing.
We work closely with a number of landlord groups, and you will see a percentage of that. We are seeing that happen. It is getting larger. Every time they expand or extend the moratorium, that's more, if you're a landlord, that's more time without your property, without access to your property. It's been 16, 17 months. Again, I don't do math, but most leases are a year, so most of them have expired. So what that is a 20-day eviction. It's for the lease is expired. It's because I don't want to rent to you anymore. And we are seeing them go up, not in as big a numbers as I think people suspect, and I'm happy to provide that data. We track it, and we provide it to the state. I can't remember, Melanie? Someone at the state, we provide that monthly, too, but I'm happy to send that over, and you can see what the increase has been.
Okay. And finally, I know you're talking to other states. How are we doing relative to other states?
So I'm going to let Amy handle that, but I think we're 33rd or something in one metric.
Yeah, they there's a lag, obviously, with the reporting. But a number of states have set up dashboards like ours that have more sort of real time. So I think the most recent information that we have at this moment is the National Low Income Housing Coalition does track what other states are reporting through their dashboards, plus what Treasury is reporting in its most recent reporting, which was through the end of June. Plus, I think they must have interns that are like scouring the newspapers or whatever, because they also have some categories where they filled in that for different states in terms of their utilization. I looked last week or earlier this week, and I believe we were 33rd on the ranking at that time in terms of the percent utilization, which is better than we were in the previous reporting period under Treasury. But we are expecting to be able to see some more information as the states put in their July numbers, and hopefully we'll be able to see some more clarity at that point too.
Just so I'm clear, Amy, utilization rate is based on demand or
no.
funding?
The total, the funding.
Okay.
The percent of the program funds, not including admin, the percent of the program funds that you expect.
Yeah, I think that's a problem.
It's not a great measure for what we're trying to do, because if $200 million is a lot, and when you add the $152 million, it's even more.
Right.
So I think that's the measure that the national conversation is focused on. I think for us locally, are we meeting the need, and are we able to get as many of the folks who, you know, we had a hard time with on the due to COVID reason into the program because of during COVID. You still have to have experienced increased expenses or loss of income. But if your car broke down during COVID, you're eligible for that second pot of money. If your car broke down during COVID, you weren't eligible for the first bucket of money. So there's, you know, are we getting as many people into this program and able to assist them I think is the right measure. And I think based on what we know or what's approximated for the need, we're doing well. We see what's in here. And so we, you know, try to get everybody through.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a real communication challenge because everybody who needs it should be able to have access to it, and that's how the program should be judged, not on the basis of how much funding we got.
It was really interesting in a conversation with Treasury where they were trying to explain to us why we could and couldn't do certain things, and they said, look, this is an emergency program that responds to this thing. It is not a program that can solve all of the rental assistance need out there. It just wasn't designed to do that. So, but we're working with each applicant to see if there's a way that they can qualify to get as many folks as we can.
Can I have a follow-up question of when will eviction data be available to see if the eviction numbers went up or if they were average or if they were below?
Yeah, so I can do it. It lags a month, but I'm going to tell you we're below still, pretty on the non-payment side. We're a little bit above on the 20-day. Because we are seeing landlords pivot to that, but it's still far. I think the last time I looked, we were like 45% below what it is in a typical year. So, and we know
so
that we're
per year, I get right because of the moratorium. But, mm-hmm. So we have to look at it on a monthly basis then, pretty much. Right?
We are. Yeah. We're tracking it on a monthly basis. It's still not where you would expect it to be.
Thank you, Christine. I have no more questions.
Thank you.
I have a couple. Just so I understand, and thank you for the dashboard, by the way. I found this very helpful. I like the transparency of it, and I like how it's updated every day. So these submitted applications, these are complete applications. You have everything needed.
We think, right? So they made it all the way through.
Right.
There's a document uploaded everywhere they're supposed to be. Whether it's the right document requires real eyes on it.
Right. But of those 3,600, it looks like 2,800 roughly have been approved or denied. There's a resolution, and then 1,000 are in final review. So pretty much you're there with complete applications.
Yes.
The issue to me, if confirm or deny, is 5,100 are just sitting there for however long, not in a complete status, not enabling you to make the fund, no fund decision.
Mm-hmm. So on the 3,500 ones, we're going to cut that in half as we deny these non-responsive ones. The need additional information.
Okay.
Within the next week or two, that'll be cut in half based on the non-responsive.
Okay.
Getting
good. And then the 130 people at the call center, they're not dedicated just to Rhode Island, are they? So we have about 150 full-time people working every day on this.
I don't even count the partners.
Right.
And we're approving maybe 50 every work day?
So approval sits strictly inside Rhode Island Housing. So the call center doesn't approve. They put it in a bucket for final review. We make the decision whether or not it meets our standards.
I know. I'm just trying to... So it's like one full-time person takes, 3 days to do a full application? I'm just, in terms of resources to results, it seems like it's a ton of resources for the results we're getting.
Yeah, so on the approval side, it takes between 25 minutes and an hour, depending on the quality of the application, to approve it. But how long it takes to fully process one depends on what you're missing and how available you are and how... responsive you are and how much assistance you need providing that back.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, so I have a question. This is kind of a bigger one. So to your point on the projected demand,
mm-hmm.
estimate 25 million, obviously we've already received double that in requests. Does the staff have an estimate of reasonably, you know, if we get to the end of the program and deem it successful, how much assistance we've provided of the $3,350,000?
So I don't think we have a projection on how much we'll be able to put out the door that is meaningful at this point. You know, the first program the due to COVID are more difficult dollars. We think that we'll be able to spend a bigger percentage of the during COVID money. So I think once we get to kind of you know, clearing out those non-responsives, we'll have a sense of what the percentage is of folks in who needed it, got it, folks in who were not eligible, and folks in who thought they needed it that day, but for whatever set of reasons, didn't a few weeks later. And so once we have those percentages, I think we can roughly apply them across the board. I think some of it's gonna depend on what happens with the virus and the economy and those kinds of things too, right? So it'll be a rough estimate, but I think we'll be able to apply those percentages across it.
And so maybe this is a question for you and Amy, but in work with national organizations, like, so I've looked at the NLIHC tracker, some states, and we've already acknowledged it's an imperfect number to just the percent of your allocation that have been awarded, but, you know, some states are over 50%. Many states have spent less, and then, you know, Rhode Island's hovering around 7. So what are the conversations with Treasury, you know, to Christine's earlier point that this was designed to be a COVID relief program, but obviously people have significant rental needs beyond that, for states to be allowed more flexibility?
We've had several conversations with Treasury. We've had several conversations with the governor's office and several conversations with the congressional delegation. We've provided them with a list of flexibility that we think we would need, as well as a, hey, we could spend these dollars on different kinds of rental assistance and things. So everyone who has Treasury's ear, and we've, you know, spoken to Treasury too, is aware of what we think we would like to see, as well as the other states through NCSHA. So
those Treasury's response has mostly been, we're aware of your concern, but has there been any, like, any indication from them that they're...
Their indication is that they'll be making, you know, additional decisions as they feel warranted.
I have a related question, Amy. Can you calculate for us what our allocation would have been if there weren't a small state exception?
I'd have to take a look at what they put out there in terms of their methodology to see if we could even calculate that.
But you could look at that.
But there were a lot of states that fell, many more states than in a normal program that would hit the small state minimum.
The 13, 14 states.
14, I think, that hit the small state minimum. And some of them would be considered relatively good-sized states from the standard of most federal programs.
Any more questions?
I have a couple more.
Sure.
Karen. So I was also interested in knowing about the denials for non-response, which I understand is as a need to shift your workload to people that are, you know, for people that are engaged and more responsive to complete their applications quickly. Can you tell me a little bit more about the response for someone who does get denied through that? You know, if they do show up again next month when their landlord's back at their door, is your documentation saved? Do they have to start from square one? Like, what does that look like for them?
So we give them a final, after all this, 5-day warning, come in and complete it. If there's no activity, we then hit the deny button. They get an email that says they've been denied. Right in that email, it says, if you think this was done in error, hit the appeal button. So if they don't appeal, they stay as denied. If they do appeal, we evaluate it, try to close it out. If they become non-responsive again, within 5 days, we deny them no appeal. In both instances, your information is still in the system. So if you're denied, you can call the call center and say, hey, you put me back in progress. Now, if you do that 3 months from now, some of your information is gonna be out of date, and we'll have to talk about what that looks like. If you, all of a sudden, for whatever reason, after you've been denied with no appeal, decide to come back in within a very limited time, You there's a button within the account where you add a case. It brings your documents with you. So again, depending on how much time has lapsed, we might need new stuff, but it's not starting over from scratch, which we think is good for people. It's less burdensome.
And so this is kind of in line of questions that Commissioner Orth had earlier, but I just kind of wonder, so, you know, obviously there's this huge call center. There's a significant number of applications that are non-responsive to phones and emails. Is there a better outreach strategy to reach these people? Like, should you be hiring canvassers? And I don't know if that's the right answer, but I just wonder if there's been any thought about, like, kind of relying on the people being proactive and available during work hours who may have non-traditional work hours, or
we text too. Okay. So we asked, and we do find that text is gets a better response from folks, because if you don't recognize the number, you don't answer it. If you get an email, you don't click on things, right? So text does get a better response. I will say that our experience in this program is very similar to the experience we had with Housing Health in Safe Harbor. Lots of people, when they got anxious, came in and applied, and then things calmed down or things changed and they went away. So we're actually seeing less of that in this program than we were in the other. So we've looked at canvassers. They're very expensive. Very, very, very expensive, and I don't know what the return would be. So we've had those conversations. But I think we're getting a better response in this program than we were in the other one. So, and you know, we've got on the ground partners who reach out to their networks all the time mm-hmm. with their group of people that they know how their preferred method of communication. And we've got partners sitting with homeless families who are in the hotel and who are in shelters filling out applications to get them into the system, because at a minimum, we can approve for security deposit and 3 months forward facing rent, right? There's a letter you get that you can take around and say, look, I got it covered for this long and I'll probably be eligible for more. So we'll continue to look at it and see if the return on that investment makes sense. But right now, I think we're doing better than we were in the old program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, considering the importance and the timeliness of this program, would you consider either having a special board meeting or having a committee review this on every two-week basis rather than the monthly basis we currently have?
I don't know about the frequency. I'll turn to Carol for that. But we have established a committee specifically with the task with figuring out some of these issues and talking about them overall. Carol, you want to talk about
it? Yeah, actually, I'll defer to Chris.
Okay.
Janet, she knows the folks that sit on that committee.
So I understand the need for updates, and we could do that as often as you like. I will tell you that any change that we make takes a while to implement. Clarabelle talked earlier about the importance of training. Every change we go to make that is designed to make something easier, we have to weigh, because it really does, with 130 people at the call center and 20 here, take a while to make sure everybody's trained. It slows them down in the beginning to make sure they're now doing a different thing. I'm happy to do what you think needs to be done, but I just be mindful of, you won't see immediate shift on any changes that we implement today. It takes between 3 and 4 weeks to get to fully see whether or not it's working, and then it takes a little bit longer to see that it what that change is. But happy to update you in any way you think is important.
We can certainly make it a priority in the report as part of that to have updates, particularly if we see changes happening with the program. And as Chairman mentioned, we have a
and the committee meetings, I think you had intended once the fall came for us to give you an update in those committee meetings every month, correct?
Okay. Carol, anything else?
The only other thing I wanted to mention, Chairman, that we became aware of that I think is a bit relevant for this program, is that municipalities have their own resources, and they are deploying regularly dollars directly to their constituents in the community. So, for example, in Cranston, also in Warwick, there are funds being deployed other than Ramsey. And I think if we hold some of the communities, we find out more in doing that. I believe even
Eastbrook test program.
So a lot of the entitlement communities are deploying funds for this. So we may not be seeing people in the community simply because they're getting those resources locally with people that they work with all the time.
We should continue to have meetings like this, but that's a good meeting this morning. Thank you for that information.
Along the same lines, Chris, under the applications by municipality, there's a null section.
Yeah, so spelling is ever important, and not everybody achieves it. So we try very hard to catch them all, but we think it's important that the first three pages get updated with the data. So we do catch it, but you're going to see null where the spelling was so messed up that they didn't know what to do with it and just went. So we'll make it a better effort to keep those out. Every now and then you'll see a Massachusetts town or Las Vegas too, because someone applied from somewhere else. So those make us laugh.
Let's turn our attention to some financing proposals, and let's start with the Rayburn Chatham Apartments. Chairman Ives, and the environmental design.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Anne Berman. This request for action is for full approval of tax exempt financing in an amount not to exceed $19,500,000, just a couple of digits there, and the capital magnet fund loan for $500,000 for Braeburn Chatham Apartments. The developer is Boulevard Capital Investments. Currently, Braeburn Apartments and Chatham Village are separate developments, each owned by affiliates of Boulevard. They were purchased, I believe they were both purchased in 2016. Braeburn, I know, is probably 40 years old. Chatham Village is probably 25 years old. Both benefit from HAP contracts, which are in the process of receiving new 20-year terms and rent increases based on the as-improved rent. The developer intends to complete more than $80,000 per unit in repairs, which is an increase from preliminary commitment. It's a significant amount for a Section 8 acquisition rehab project. The increase in construction is primarily a result of two things. There's an overall scope increase, as well as sort of general construction costs are going up. There was also a fire at Chatham Village, so they traded off some of the acquisition price, took the insurance proceeds, and that's also incorporated into the higher number. So overall, the increase was about $1 million. Boulevard Capital's requested that Rhode Island Housing provide conduit financing as part of a back-to-back transaction with Citibank. And both the size of the bond and the permanent loan have increased since preliminary due to the increase in approved rents in Citibank's underwriting. So the loan will have two tranches, a permanent piece and a construction piece. Most importantly, Citibank will be the lender of record and loan servicer. Citibank and subsequently Freddie Mac will bear all of the financial risk associated with the loan. Boston Financial is the syndicator. They're paying 90 cents for the credits. And Barkin Property Management is the property manager. So this request for action is for firm approval of a tax-exempt loan in the amount of $19,500,000. Of which $13,250,000 will remain as the permanent loan, and the capital magnet loan of $500,000 for Braeburn Chatham.
I believe the credit committee looked at this.
Yes, we did, Nick. Thank you very much, Ann, for the presentation. It's a very strong proposal, a large level of renovation proposed. And very limited risk to Rhode Island Housing, as Ann mentioned, because we're simply acting as a conduit issuer here and receiving an ongoing issuance fee as a result of that. So the committee does recommend approval for this financing.
Great, I'll accept that as a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion, any questions?
I have a question.
Question.
Just one, really, if you could. Because I'm somewhat naive on these things, I'm not familiar. Is there any concern at all about the loan-to-value increasing from 79% to 90%? Page 2 of the summary.
No, and that's actually, just to clarify that, under the appraisal, the loan-to-value was 79%.
Okay.
And the lender's loan-to-value is 90% loan-to-value. And I think essentially the difference has to do with the operating expenses. I think the appraisal sort of went out and did kind of a market analysis, and the lender's underwriting is based on what the developer is actually going to use as operating expenses, which we think are much more realistic.
Okay.
So no concern.
No more questions. Thank you, ma'am.
Any other questions? Corby, we have two matters relating to Graham Chatham. Can we couple them as one?
We need to do two separate votes,
okay.
But we can discuss them together if that's your preference.
Well, we just have the other. So why don't we take a vote? If we could have to vote on the approval of financing for Braeburn Chatham Apartments.
Yes. This is Corinne Meyer speaking. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you're in favor of providing firm approval of financing for Braeburn Chatham Apartments in Providence, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Rostinas?
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns?
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister?
Aye.
Commissioner Orth?
Aye.
Director Tanner?
Aye.
And Director Thorson?
Aye.
The motion is approved by a unanimous vote.
The next matter has to do with the authorization issue tax credit exempt loan to support the development of Rayburn Chatham Apartments. Anything else to do with that?
No.
No. We'll accept that as a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further comment? Hearing none, we'll take a vote.
This is Corinne Myers. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of authorizing the issuance of a tax-exempt loan in the amount of $19,500,000 to support the redevelopment of Rayburn Chatham Apartments in Providence, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Rostinas?
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns?
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister?
Aye.
Commissioner Orth?
Aye.
Director Tanner?
Aye.
Director Thorson?
Aye.
The motion is approved by a unanimous vote. Thank you.
Thank you. The next item is preliminary approval of financing for Living East Bay. And again, Ann Berman will present the report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Ann Berman. This request for action is for preliminary approval of a tax-exempt construction loan of $4,750,000, a taxable first mortgage of $430,000, and a capital magnet loan of $785,000 for a development that will be known as Living East Bay. Currently, Living East Bay is a number of separate portfolios located primarily in Bristol. There is one building that's in Warren. Collectively, there's 47 apartments with bedroom sizes that range from one to four bedroom units. And I would say that they're generally in average condition, both interior and on the exterior, with a fair amount of deferred maintenance. The developer's preliminary construction budget is about $2.3 million, or almost $50,000 a unit. The primary focus is envelope and interior unit upgrades. The project is underwritten to the lower of market or the various program rents at each unit. And there are quite a number of mobile vouchers at the site, but for underwriting purposes, we're not underwriting to mobile vouchers because they can leave the site. So the capital stack currently includes the proceeds from this tax-exempt financing, a permanent taxable loan, LIHTC equity, capital magnet loan, both home and HTF, which have previously received preliminary approval, and rollover of existing Rhode Island housing debt as well as some sponsor loans. And as part of our approval process, we have determined that the development and sponsor meet our requirements for rollover debt. So staff is recommending approval, preliminary approval, for the attached resolutions authorizing $4,750,000 in tax-exempt financing, a taxable permanent loan of $430,000, and a CMF loan for $785,000.
Thank you. Again, our credit committee has reviewed this.
Yes, we did. Thank you, Nick. This is preliminary approval, not final approval. We understand the staff is still really digging into this one. There apparently are over 30 soft loans and grants on these several little properties. So I think this will be a good exercise to consolidate and clean up this overall development. The acquisition price, we question whether that can be substantiated, but there is an appraisal in hand at market rents, assuming the income rent restrictions weren't there. And when to market does support that, the acquisition price is also just to pay off existing debt. So all of these new resources going into the property really are going into the renovation of the property and to continue its affordability going forward. So we do have a few questions about it, but we think that we definitely approve moving forward with the preliminary, providing preliminary approval for the financing rather.
Thank you. I'll accept that as a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Any questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
And I was looking in the summary and something caught my attention, deviations from standard underwriting. Yes. Can you please explain the failure of the bridge loan test and why that shouldn't really concern us?
Sure. There's some quirky rules under the low-income housing tax credit program. as well as tax-exempt bond financing. So under tax-exempt bond financing, in order to generate tax credits on all 47 units, you have to issue tax-exempt bonds that are greater than 50% of the eligible basis of the project. So when you do that math, essentially, which is required by the program, that 4.7 million basically fails our test, which requires that the loans be no more than 90% of the loan to cost. And it's, we have two bridge loan tests. It passes one, it doesn't pass the other. But at the end of the day, that loan is being paid off through the syndication equity plus some of the soft loans, so which we all control, which we basically hold all that money. So that's why we're comfortable with the deviation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'd just like to add to that that we did discuss that in a committee, and typically when a project fails to meet one of the tests, we look to see some mitigation measures put in place to reduce our repayment risk. And one of those might be having the equity sponsor contribute more than the minimum at closing. I think we have a 15% minimum. We went back and we're going to ask for a 20% minimum. We'll see if we get that. But other guarantees and also pledges of the limited partners' equity in the transaction and their ownership interest. So trying to put a little bit more teeth into the transaction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Mm-hmm. Been appropriately moved and seconded. Any further questions? Hearing none, let's ask for a vote.
This is Corinne Meyer speaking. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of providing preliminary approval of financing for Living East Bay and Bristol and Warren, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Racinus.
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns.
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister.
Aye.
Commissioner Orr.
Aye.
Director Tanner.
Aye.
Director Thorson.
Aye.
The motion is approved by unanimous vote. Thank you.
Thank you. The next item is the approval and transfer of physical assets for Riverstone Apartments in Pawtucket. And again, we're asking Ann.
Thank you. This is Ann Burns. So this is a administrative action required under the general rules governing the multifamily loan program. And it is a request for approval of the transfer of the limited partnership interest in a property that's in our portfolio called Riverstone Apartments Limited. Limited partnership. It's located in Pawtucket. You may recall that in November of 2020, the board approved the transfer of the general partner of this property. Subsequent to that, the limited partner, who's sort of a more smaller boutique investor, made the determination that it was prudent for them to also transfer their interest at the time. So that's this request. Basically, they're requesting the transfer of the limited partnership interest from affiliates of Michael Associates to a LIHTC investment fund managed by the Candor Group LLC. And so we are seeking approval of the transfer of the limited partner interest in Riverside Apartments from Countryside Corporate Tax Credits 11 Limited Partnership and Michael Properties LLC to a fund called the Community Development and Affordable Housing Fund 5 and the CF Fund 1 Riverstone Special FPE Owner LLC, which are the transferees. Again, this is purely administrative.
Again, I'll ask our credit committee to comment.
Yes, we reviewed it, and the request meets all of the requirements, and as Ann says, it's that's a procedural matter. We had no comments on it and recommend approval.
I take that as a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Hearing none, let's take a vote.
This is Corinne Meyer speaking. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of approving a transfer of physical assets or TPA for Riverstone Apartments in Pawtucket, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Racinus?
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Byrne?
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister?
Aye.
Commissioner Orth?
Aye.
Director Tanner?
Aye.
Director Thorson?
Aye.
The motion is approved by unanimous vote. Thank you.
Thank you. The next is the approval of the engagement payment processing firm. Leslie?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Leslie McKnight.
This request for action is for approval to engage CDT Technologies Limited, doing business as Repay, to provide Rhode Island Housing with a customer-facing digital portal and electronic processing services. Rhode Island Housing issued an RFP in April 2021 seeking proposals for qualified firms to provide payment processing services. The RFP was posted on Rhode Island Housing's website and the website maintained by the state of Rhode Island Department of Business Administration's Division of Purchases. 7 firms submitted proposals in response to the RFP. A selection committee comprised of members of the loan servicing, information technology, finance, and compliance areas reviewed the proposals and evaluated them in accordance with the criteria outlined in the RFP. The committee assigned Repay a score of 89 out of a possible 100. Repay currently provides payment processing services to approximately 30 mortgage clients, including other housing finance agencies, and is an existing Rhode Island Housing vendor. The review committee was impressed by Repay's processes, web interface capabilities, and pricing plan, and feels that Repay is best positioned to offer existing and new services to our customers. The approximate cost of the engagement for an initial 3-year term is $556,000.
It was reviewed by the management committee in the absence of the chair, Commissioner conducted the meeting.
Yes, so as you said, this was reviewed by the management committee. The portal will help add a functionality for customers or ability to pay by debit, biweekly payments to help accelerate their prepayment. And because it's an existing vendor, reduce some of the costs of startup with this vendor. So the committee recommended passage.
I'll take that as a motion also. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, let's take a vote.
This is Corinne Myers speaking. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of approving the engagement of a payment processing firm as presented, say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Racinus?
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Byrne?
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister?
Aye.
Commissioner Orth?
Aye.
Director Tanner?
Aye.
Director Thorson?
Aye.
The motion is approved by a unanimous vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is to engage a provider of real estate development and asset management software. And again, Lisa Primiano to report.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. This is Lisa Primiano. This request for action before you is to license software to support and automate the life cycle of our development and asset management areas. This product will provide modules for origination, underwriting, funding allocation, closing, tax credit allocation, asset management, and compliance. Right now, we utilize several different software products and spreadsheets to accomplish this life cycle. So this product will be a start to finish for the entire area, including both the development and asset management. On October 1st, 2020, we advertised an RFP for software vendors. We received 9 responses to that RFP. And we formed a selection committee. We had a number of development staff and asset management staff engaged. We spent a very long time looking very, very carefully at all of the proposals. You'll see in the attachment A that we have the scoring criteria as well as the scoring for each of those vendors. We found 2 top vendors and we did a full review with them and then we checked references. And the recommendation unanimously of the committee was to engage ProLink. They're a Colorado-based company. They work with other HFAs. We have very good references from Utah and Kansas. I know that Ann and Mike DeCaro spent a lot of time talking to their colleagues at the other HFAs. And before you today is a request for your approval to engage ProLink for a 3-year contract. And the amount of the contract is $737,000. Some of that is an implementation fee, so the first year is an additional fund, and then it's approximately $200,000 going forward. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think the management committee also reviewed this report. Commissioner Byrne?
Correct, Chairman. As Lisa covered, this report will help streamline the software used by these departments and processes across development and asset management staff, and will provide a start-to-finish solution for housing development projects, and we recommend passage.
Accept that as a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion?
I have a question. Lisa, is this, will this input all the existing multifamily developments into the system as
eventually,
well?
Eventually, yes. We will bring all of the other developments into this software product.
And that's included in the cost?
That would be an additional cost that we would be doing that on the staff level.
Okay.
So ProLink would not be importing that data for us.
It just seems like a high price. What are we doing? We're only doing maybe a dozen multifamily deals a year, something like that.
Well, this would capture other transactions as well, Commissioner. So this is all of the other ancillary financing developments as well that have, you know, requirements around deed restrictions that our asset management group works with.
Right. I think this is a very good idea. I don't want you to misunderstand my point. I just want to make sure that we're going to get everything in the system and that we're not going to be paying through the nose for that.
So because we have a data warehouse in place right now, that data warehouse can feed the information back. So it is not going to be a manual process to get the information back into this system.
Okay.
So that is part of the process that will connect with the data warehouse.
And this will also connect with our one-stop.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you.
Properly moved and seconded. Any further questions? If not, let's take a roll.
This is Corinne Meyer speaking. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of approving the engagement of a provider of real estate development and asset management software as presented, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Ristina?
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns?
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister?
Aye.
Commissioner Orth?
Aye.
Director Tanner?
Aye.
Director Thorson?
Aye.
The motion is approved by unanimous vote. Thank you.
That concludes the open meeting. We now need a motion to go into closed session to discuss the performance review of senior managers. Will someone make such a motion?
Move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none, let's take a vote.
This is Corinne Myers. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you are in favor of convening in closed session pursuant to Rhode Island General Laws Section 4246-5A1 to discuss the job performance of the executive staff, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. Chairman Ristina?
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns?
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister?
Aye.
Commissioner Orth?
Aye.
Director Tanner?
Aye.
Director Thorson?
Aye.
The motion is approved by a unanimous vote. This is Corinne Myers continuing to speak. I'd like to note for the record that the members of the executive staff, namely James Comer, Christine Hunsinger, Kara LaChapelle, Lisa Primiano, and myself, have been notified in writing that this body intends to convene in closed session to discuss the performance of executive staff, and that the discussion may be requested to take place in open session. To my knowledge, no objections have been raised.
Thank you.
I'd like to add staff and members of the public are welcome to remain on the telephone line until the Board of Commissioners returns, but the time frame for that is uncertain.
Anything else, Corinne?
And with that,
bye-bye.
Carol and I will.
And their phone is off?
Yes.
Yes.
Chairman, do you have what you need?
The Board of Commissioners are resuming.
Corey, we decided not to have any more votes, ever. We have enough votes for the day. Corey, just so you know how to take us home with this, we have reconvened and announced an open session. What shall we do next? We've concluded our work, no votes were taken.
Mr. Chairman, do you wish there be a motion to seal the minutes of the closed session?
Yes, there should be such minutes. Such a seal.
And has that motion been made and seconded? I'm sorry, perhaps I...
I'll second that.
Moved and seconded.
Okay. In that case, this is Corinne Myers taking a roll call vote. An affirmative vote is required for this particular motion. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you're in favor of sealing the minutes of the closed session, please say aye. If you're opposed, say nay. Chairman Ritsinas.
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns.
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister.
Aye.
Commissioner Orth.
Aye.
Director Tanner.
Aye.
And Director Wilson.
Aye.
The motion is approved by unanimous vote. Thank you.
Can we now adjourn?
You may.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
No comments necessary? Take a roll. Call vote.
This is Corinne Myers. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you're in favor of adjourning this meeting, please say aye. If you're opposed, say nay. Chairman Ritsinas.
Aye.
Commissioner Designee Burns.
Aye.
Commissioner McAllister.
Aye.
Commissioner Orth.
Aye.
Director Tanner.
Aye.
Director Thornton.
Aye.
The motion is approved by a unanimous vote.
Meeting is now adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you. We will be moving into